The Philip Morris Playhouse, presented by the makers of Philip Morris cigarettes and originally scheduled for this period over most of these stations, will not be broadcast tonight due to the special program which follows immediately.
The following 30 minutes have been purchased by the Republican National Committee for a campaign address by Governor Earl Warren, Republican candidate for the Vice Presidency of the United States. Governor Warren is speaking from the Civic Auditorium in San Francisco. The program will be opened by Mr. James J. Sullivan, chairman of the San Francisco Dewey Warren Campaign Headquarters. Mr. Sullivan.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is my extreme pleasure to present a distinguished Californian, a lifelong Democrat, one who was San Francisco campaign manager for Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1940 and 1944. A man who places the welfare of the nation above partisan politics, supervisor of the city and county of San Francisco, Dan Gallagher.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe in Governor Earl Warren. His executive ability, his achievements in the interest of the aged, the blind, the needy children, the wage earner, housing for the veteran and the underprivileged, in all truly humanitarian activities as governor of the Golden State of California, have shown him to be a truly liberal and progressive leader. His record and that of Governor Dewey in New York parallel one another. They are truly a great team. My friends, I am deeply honored as I present the governor of the Golden State of California, the next vice president of the United States, Earl Warren.
Thank you very, very much, Dan. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Chairman Dan Gallagher and my fellow Americans of San Francisco, this is a great San Francisco welcome, a welcome measuring up to the saying heard all over the world that San Francisco knows how. I thank you from my heart for the encouragement you give me through such a wonderful gathering as we have here tonight. It is great to be back here on San Francisco Bay, where I have spent so many years of my life. Among the friends and neighbors whose goodwill and confidence I hold more precious than anything else in my years of public service, it is always the same here in San Francisco, friendly and hospitable. I have just had one of the most wonderful privileges that can come to any American. I have traveled through 7 weeks, through 35 states of the Union. I have met our fellow Americans in 150 cities and towns. During the last week, I have been up and down our own state. I have been deeply impressed by the friendliness and the fairness of the American people everywhere. They came out, regardless of their political affiliation, to hear what I had to say in this campaign. I have come to realize more clearly than ever before that the people of every city, town, and state depend for their welfare upon their unknown neighbors in every other town, city, and state in the nation. This country of ours is really one great going concern. Its people, wherever they live and work, are neighbors. We face the future together. Every American worker, manager, farmer, and housewife is on the team. No one is unimportant. All must pull together. Whatever contributes to better living, better government, better Americanism in any one family, town, city, or state adds just that much spirit and strength to the nation. Whatever makes for defeatism, prejudice, disunity anywhere drains from our country's spirit and strength everywhere. We are now approaching the end of this national campaign, which involves the welfare of our country and its security for years ahead. Every American, in whatever state he may live, must be at his or her best. Each should act as though the future of the nation depended on him or her alone, upon the care with which he or she exercises the hard-won, precious privilege of the vote, through which we share responsibility for the future. No one should shirk that responsibility. No one should treat it lightly. Partisanship, selfish interest, prejudice, all small things should give way to one great overriding consideration: what is best for our country. I come before you tonight in the role of a campaigner, and although you are my friends and neighbors of the San Francisco Bay Area, you have the right and the duty as Americans to regard me as a campaigner and to test everything I have to say accordingly by my dependability in the past and by the reasonableness of my approach. As a campaigner, I feel deeply about the predicament in which this country of ours finds itself today. I am convinced that we must and can give to this country the kind of leadership it badly needs and deserves. But even as a campaigner, I have not sought, nor has my colleague Tom Dewey sought, to gain our point at the expense of disrupting the essential unity of the American people. For after all, that is what any successful national administration must ultimately rely upon in the years ahead. We have not even permitted ourselves to be taunted into doing so. We would rather lose this election than make a campaign designed to whip up section against section, group against group, or man against man. It is one thing to review the record and point out the facts, and there are plenty of them, but it is another thing to call names, impugn motives, spread fear, and heap blame on others regardless of responsibility. It does not take a great statesman or any particular skill to say that this country of ours is beset by very serious troubles. Any housewife knows all about the high cost of living. Any worker knows about the dwindling value of the dollar in his paycheck. Any citizen can feel the effects of high taxes. Millions of families know that there is a tremendous housing shortage. All of us realize that there is still a tremendous job to be done in this country to round out our educational, our health, our social security services. Every American realizes the fateful consequences of what we do and how we do it in our foreign relations. I think we can go even further and say that most Americans realize all of these things are bound up with the Depression of the 30s, the grim war of the early 40s, and this Cold War of the late 40s. They realize that they are an accumulation of chronic ailments and cannot be solved overnight by any one law, any one formula, or any kind of quick cure-all. Certainly, they cannot be solved merely by charging the blame for them against any one person or any one party. Even if it were of any use to try to fix the blame, most Americans find it hard to understand how a national administration, which has been in power continuously during the last 16 years, can seriously claim that all these troubles have been caused by a political party that has been out of office during all of that time. The American people are questioning the dependability of a national administration that resorts to that kind of argument. And I believe they are going to retire that administration. They will get rid of it, not so much because they believe it is to blame for all our troubles, but because they believe it is too confused to be able to solve them. The question which I am sure most Americans have in their mind today is, which political party, which political leadership offers the best hope for bringing this country through its domestic problems and its foreign crisis? Realizing not only the existence but the seriousness of our problems, the American people are more concerned with bringing about a united effort for their solution than with quarreling over who is responsible for them. That is why people throughout the nation are appraising the present national administration not according to its party label or its charges against others, but by its own performance. This kind of an appraisal is based on common sense. And furthermore, it squares with the very purpose for which our political party system exists. Every American, reviewing the history of this country, can see that both major parties have at times made great contributions to the progress of the nation. But they can also see that both parties have at times faltered and sometimes failed. At such time, the people, and by the people I mean both Democrats and Republicans, basing their judgment on performance rather than party label, have not hesitated to dismiss a weak, discordant, or ineffective administration. They have invariably turned to the other party for new blood, new life, and new leadership. That, I believe firmly, is the situation which the American people recognize today. They recognize it not because of political arguments made in this campaign, but because of facts they have witnessed themselves. The present national administration has been in office for 16 years. That is just twice as long as the span of useful life estimated for any national administration by the wise, far-seeing First President of the United States. He realized that a national administration, like most human institution, grows tired with the years. It becomes cocksure over its initial successes, burdened with its own past mistakes, clumsy with bureaucracy, and beset with squabbling by internal factions that regard it as their own. This sorry spectacle has already led both Democrats and Republicans in the Congress to take action. They have joined in submitting to the people a constitutional amendment that will limit the presidency of the United States to 2 terms to prevent just such deterioration in the future. The present administration is not really a whole national administration. It is only a remnant of one. It is merely what is left of what was once a national administration. The Wallaceites have walked out to form their own party. Southern states, upon which the administration depended in the past, have seceded in anger. And both groups, one operating from the left, the other from the right, would harass every program of the Democratic administration, even if it were returned to power. The bosses of the big city machines to which the administration truckled for votes in the past have likewise openly attacked their party leadership. They support it today only because it is their one hope for the political patronage that is their lifeblood. And what are the good Democrats of California going to say to their party leaders right here in our own state? On the eve of the Democratic National Convention, these state leaders declared their open contempt for the present national administration in letters and at public meetings. They not only accused it of incompetence, but sought to replace it with new leadership. But now, in this campaign, they trifle with the intelligence of their Democratic followers. With tongue in cheek, they give lip service to that same administration. They do this for reasons no more important than their personal so-called party regularity. The present administration has been unable to work out a program upon which even its own party members in the Congress can agree. Time and time again, Democrats in the last Congress have bolted the leadership of their party and voted in substantial numbers with the Republicans. On 2 of the most important issues arising in the last Congress, Democrats voted to override their own leader's presidential veto. Not just some Democrats, not just many Democrats, but a majority of all the Democrats in both houses of the Congress. And let me go further into the record and recall to your mind that the present administration has not only been unable to get along with the present Congress, which is Republican, but it was also unable to get along with the one that preceded it, which was Democratic. And why have the Democrats in Congress rebelled against the administration? Here again we have facts, not arguments. Facts that are as evident to the Democrats in Congress as they are to everyone throughout the nation. How could they, with confidence follow a leadership that brands procedures as police state methods one day and advocates them almost the next day. How could they follow an administration that announces the dropping of programs on one day with the statement that they will do more harm than good to the nation, and then ask their reinstatement a short time later as a sure panacea for inflation? How could they follow the gyrations of an administration that makes a practice of approving important legislation by signing it, and at the very same time, and by the very same act, publicly condemning it? How can American working men understand an administration that cuddles up to them at one time and at another time hysterically demands the power to draft striking American workers into the army? How can Americans understand an administration that one day urges speedy and thorough action by the Congress to cure what the president himself described as the economic warfare of strikes and lockouts, and then condemn the Congress for taking the action it requested? How could any veteran, still fresh with the horror and sacrifice of the last war, or any mother already worrying about the next, have any feeling of security under an administration that approves a speech by Henry Wallace on the delicate subject of foreign relations one day and fires him for making it the next day? How could any dyed-in-the-wool party adherent restrain himself from crying enough when that same administration, unable to learn from its earlier blunder, repeats the performance within the last few weeks by dangerously embarrassing its own Secretary of State during the most critical period of our relations with Russia? How could there be any Democratic or Republican confidence in an administration that so loses its sense of balance as to describe all who disagree with it as pitchforkers, gluttons, and saboteurs, that charges Russia with aggression and launches a policy of firmness concerning it one day, and then suddenly confuses America and every foreign office in the world with the amazing announcement of, "I like old Joe"? How could earnest Americans feel that the nerve centers of the nation are being adequately protected against communists by an administration that asks for $25 million to get them out of its own ranks and then charges red herring when anyone else tries to find out where they are? No matter how much the American people may be inclined to give full credit for good intentions, no matter how much party members may be wedded to partisanship, the single facts are such as to convince any American that something just has to be done about it. We can do something about it next week. We can retire the present administration. We can do this not in bitterness, but with proper recognition for its achievements of earlier years. We can do it by electing Tom Dewey, President of the United States. Tom Dewey is a fine American. I have known him and worked with him through the years. His record of public service is an open book. His abilities have always been used on the side of law and order against corruption and rackets. His administrative experience has been gained in bringing good government, efficient and humane, to the most populated and diversified state of the Union. His fine ambition, about to be realized, is to give to this country the energy of his comparative youth, the benefit of his long experience, and the trained good judgment we must have today to protect the welfare and security of America. He is too intelligent to believe that he can do this alone. He knows he must have a team and a Republican Congress to help him do it. Here in San Francisco, I hope that along with your veteran congressman, my old friend Dick Welsh, you will also elect to the new... You will also elect to the new team that fine, clean-cut, young Republican, Bill Maillard. Tom Dewey is too honest to delude the American people with high-sounding but heartbreaking promises couched in terms of patent medicine formulas. He understands that the job ahead of us is one in which labor, management, agriculture, and government, both federal and state, have a joint responsibility. His record demonstrates that he knows how to work with every one of them. He will attack the causes of our ills instead of proposing cure-alls for their symptoms. He will stand firmly against every selfish and narrow interest. There will be one rule of conduct for all, every group and every section of our country. He will insist on absolute honesty and efficiency in every department under his control. He will make it clear to every appointee that his only policy is to hew to the line of the public interest without political favoritism or enmity toward any group or any individual. He will bring both character and competence to our national government, and the Republican Party will follow his leadership. Personally, my friends, I will dedicate myself to the fulfillment of that same cause. It is in this spirit and with this pledge that I come to you, the people of my neighboring city of San Francisco, to ask your confidence for a new administration under the leadership of my friend, my fellow governor on the other side of the continent, our standard bearer, Tom Dewey, the next president of the United States.
You've just heard an address by Governor Earl Warren, Republican candidate for the Vice Presidency of the United States. Time for this campaign address by Governor Warren was purchased by the Republican National Committee.
The Philip Morris Playhouse, presented by the makers of Philip Morris cigarettes over most of these stations, was not broadcast tonight due to the special program which you've just heard. Tune in for the Philip Morris Playhouse at the regularly scheduled time next Friday evening. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.